All right, welcome to 205 with Rodney Clausen, which I guess we haven't spent any real time together. We've met for the first time about six times. And people are always like, this is Rodney. I'm like, yeah, we've met like six times. a lot through your wife. Because your wife and I have become friends.
Oh yeah.
But I'd see you and I'd be like, hey Rodney. And I'd be like, have you guys met? We're like, we've only met, but we've met many, many times. So it's good to have you. We were going over some of your stuff. We have a wall on the screen, Rodney, that we put everybody's songs on. We couldn't fit all your songs. You have so many number one songs.
Well, I mean, I know there's people out there that have a lot more than me, but I don't know.
There isn't a right response, right? Like, I just kind of let it hang and then see what they say. Yeah, yeah. That's what my therapist has me do. She goes, just say thank you. Yeah.
I'm shocked when I see it too. So I'm like, how in the hell did that happen? You know. So
because each song, the worth of it, we have estimated you're worth $1 billion with all. Are you saying over or under a billion?
I would say well under.
Well over. Got it.
That means Ashley Gorley's worth $2 billion. So.
Well, you are in the, and I'll get off this, but you are in the elite three. We have something we call the elite three artists that have the most number ones that have been on the podcast, and you are part of that. And if there was a room, we'd all clap and probably give you a standing ovation. And there's not a trophy, but we'll mail one to you.
Okay.
It may never come to you, but trust us, we may.
So what is the trophy?
We don't know yet. We haven't actually invented it. We just say it, and then we never send it out, actually.
It's something to hold your billion dollars.
You know what? I'll tell you what. It's a belt. It's a championship belt. Okay. Yeah, you'll be receiving it in the mail. Just watch for
it. That's
cool. So what's interesting about your story is you actually were writing songs, and they were having a bit of success before you even moved to Nashville.
Right, yeah.
So you were in Texas, kind of up in the panhandle?
Yeah, I got out of college and farmed with my dad for 15 years and had some connections here in Nashville and started writing songs and had three or four hits before I moved out here in 2005. So I got a publishing deal in 2000 and went back and forth for 5 or 6 years. And then my dad retired and I moved out here full time.
So you got a publishing deal without living here.
Right.
Which at least, I don't know about then, but now that's pretty rare. Because part of the publishing deal, when people sign you, is they want to set you up on rights all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're setting you up on a publishing deal, I guess was part of that they wanted you to write not only in town, but to pay you to keep writing at home too?
Yeah, I mean, I would come to town 1 week a month and I would have, you know, half-written stuff. I would write a few things by myself and, you know, I'd have, hey, here's a verse and a chorus, you know, do you like it or not? And I wrote a few hits like that, you know, so.
You were farming, you said 15 years?
Yeah.
So you finished school, what kind of farm?
Corn, wheat, soybeans, the big center pivot sprinklers, you know, in the Texas Panhandle where it rains like 15 inches a year, so it's almost desert.
So you're living the country song.
Right, yeah.
I mean, out of school, you lived the adult country song.
Right, yeah.
And what did your dad...
I was the guy driving the tractor listening to the country songs that now we're trying. I try to like plug in like, will the guy on the tractor understand this? Which the guy on the tractor is not maybe the core audience anymore, but back when I started, it was, I think. So.
As you were writing songs while living on the farm and you were working, what'd your dad think about maybe the ambition that you had to be a songwriter?
What's funny is my family, my mom and dad aren't musical at all. So they were supportive, but I don't know if they even understood what I was trying to do. Which, I mean, after I had a publishing deal and had several hit songs, I would come back home. I would come to Nashville and write and come back home, and they would say, like, did you sell any songs this week? They didn't. I mean, I explained the business to them so many times. And I don't know if they still understand what I do. They do know that my songs get played on the radio, though. So.
And you grew up, like, what what town would you be closest to?
I grew up 5 miles west of Groover, Texas.
Okay, you got to help me with Groover.
Gruver. It's 90 miles north of Amarillo.
Now that I know.
I tell people to get on I-40 and go 14 hours west, and you'll hit Amarillo, and then go 90 miles north. So
I know Amarillo pretty well. We just played a show in Amarillo.
Okay.
The thing about Amarillo, too, is that's the part of Texas that gets snow.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's about the only part of Texas that really gets snow.
Yeah, we've had some big snows.
So you guys got seasons in Texas.
Oh yeah.
So you finish school, you're working on the farm, you're writing songs. Are you like, I'm just trying to understand what that was like. Are you carrying a guitar as through the day? Like if there's some downtime?
No, I would maybe on the tractor, I would get an idea in my head. And I mean, it's so different than what I do now, because it's like, we'll go, you know, you go in, you meet a couple buddies, somebody has an idea, you try to write the song in like one day. Well, I'd had like weeks to work on an idea, like driving the tractor, you know. But I would mainly, you know, put stuff down with a guitar, like go home at night and, you know, 10 o'clock at night, go in with a guitar and try to write like that too for a couple hours.
Where did that guitar, just the music, come from if your parents weren't musical, or that influence wasn't there every day?
Well, I mean, I played piano growing up, and I was in band and choir, and I learned how to play guitar. Probably, I think I bought a guitar when I was maybe 20 years old.
Oh, so a little later.
I mean, I didn't try to write my first song till I was, I think, like 28, maybe.
It wasn't like four? Like most people, I was four, and I wrote my first song.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a weird story that I don't like to share it with people because it just sounds weird, but I had a friend of mine who left Gruber, Texas, and came out here to Nashville and went to Belmont and got in the publishing world out here, and she randomly called me, hadn't talked to her in 2 or 3 years, randomly called me one night and said, "Hey, you're a songwriter and you don't know it." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And she said, I'm hanging out with songwriters all the time here in Nashville, and they all remind me of you. So you need to try to write a song and send it to me."
Oh, so she was seeing you in other people.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it probably took me a year to write her a song and send it to her, and it was horrible. But she like picked out a couple of lines and said, this is great. This is what you need to do. And did that for a couple of years. And then I knew John Rich from Lone Star. I was his junior high basketball coach when I was going to college.
Really?
And so I knew John, and he was 12 and I was 20. So I would go to class all day, and then I would go coach at this, I went to West Texas A&M. I'd go to class. Then I would go coach at this Christian school in Amarillo, San Jacinto Christian Academy. And his dad is a Pentecostal preacher. So obviously his kid went to a private Christian school. So I knew John. I coached John for 3 years. His parents got a divorce. He ended up moving back here to Tennessee. And he would call me like once a year. It'd be like, "Hey, coach, I'm Roy Acuff at Opryland, you know, Opryland theme park." And then, "Hey, coach, I'm in a band called Texas C," which turned into Lone Star, you know. And then, the first time I ever came to Nashville, he said, "Hey, coach, we're going in to cut our second record. You should come hang out in the studio." So I flew out here, and he picked me up at the airport, and I went to, I think it was called the Sound Shop. It was over there by the roundabout. Little studio there, and walked in, and Don Cook and Wally Wilson were producing the second Lone Star record. No, it was actually, it was the first Lone Star record. So I walked in a studio, and I heard they recorded No News, Come Crying to Me, like 2 or 3 hit songs. And this is the first time in Nashville, an hour after I get off the plane, I'm in a studio watching Brent Mason and all these session guys cutting these songs that were going to become hit songs in the next year. It was like, I don't know, baptism by fire. I don't know what you would call that, but it was like, holy crap, you know, this is cool. You know, maybe I can do this. So
let me back it up a second. That's such a good story, but let's go into John Rich as a ball player. First of all, you as a ball player, let's just start there. If you're coaching, were you an athlete as a kid?
Yeah, I played, I went, you know, small town, 1,500 people. I played basketball, football, ran track, played a year of college football, quickly figured out that if I was ever going to get through school, I just needed to go to school. And so, yeah, I mean, but, you know, small town, you do everything. I also did band and choir, too. So, but John was a pretty good basketball player. But he was 5'7 or 5'8, like in seventh grade. And he's still 5'7 or 5'8. But he was pretty good.
And he was a 5'7 seventh grader, was he playing like underneath? Was he just a good guard? He was like a tall guard?
He was like a forward.
Was he?
Yeah.
And then his position slowly forward into a shooting guard.
He moved, I think in eighth or ninth grade, he moved back here. So that was it for my coaching him. So.
And you guys stayed in contact, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you must have had some sort of impact on him in some way, even as a college. I mean, I'm still close-ish with my high school football coach who had a big impact on me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I about once a year I reach out and go, hey, I'm in Lone Star. I tell him the same thing. I just say, hey, I'm in Lone Star. He never believes it. But so you come and you hop to the studio and you see this. Now, are you thinking at that time when you see Lone Star cutting a record that they're going to be something? Or are you like, wow, look at this guy that I know, like, trying to make something. I don't know what's happening here. Or are you so overwhelmed by it all? I just don't know.
I mean, it might have been their second record. They may have already had a hit. I mean, y'all could probably research that. What songs Come Crying to Me and what was it? There was another song.
I guess my point is it weird that John Rich made it? Is that weird that he made it as an artist?
He's made it like three or four times.
Since then, yes.
I went through the whole deal with him. It was like he was in Lone Star, then he got kicked out of Lone Star, then he got a record deal at RCA, and I think he lost that record deal because he dunked Joe Galani in a hot tub at the ACM Awards out in Vegas.
Which you don't want to do.
That's the wrong thing to do. Yeah, yeah. And then he ended up, they started Music Mafia, and then he ended up with Big and Rich. So he's had like three different record deals, and in between there, he won ASCAP Songwriter of the Year just as a songwriter. So that he was a really, you know, musically he was someone good to know and a good, like, okay, here's what I need to do, here's what I don't need to do as far as the songwriting part goes.
Are you guys still cool?
Yeah. Yeah, we write a couple times a year. We had a cut on McGraw's last record called California that they ended up putting out on their own as Big and Rich. But, yeah, we still write some good songs together. So
let's focus on Tim McGraw for 1 second. Here are a couple Tim McGraw songs that you wrote here. Both went number one. Let's do Southern Girl from Tim McGraw. And here is One of Those Nights, another Tim McGraw number one. She slides in and you roll down Main Street. You turn right when the red light turns green. When you hear both of those, which one of those can you actually remember hopping into the room more? Which one?
I remember both of those really well, actually.
Okay, well then let's do Southern Girl.
Southern Girl was the first time I had written with Jaron Johnston.
From Cadillac 3.
And Lee Miller brought a big chunk of that song already written. I mean, hats off to Lee on that one. And we finished, we took what he kind of had and finished it all the way out. He already had the roadmap on that one. And then Jaron took it home to his place and did like his cool little, he still does GarageBand. He's never done Pro Tools.
He hasn't moved up from GarageBand.
But you would think it's Pro Tools because it sounds great. And he added that cool little post-chorus thing, like Southern Girl, Rock My World. He added that on his own after we wrote the song. So I guess what I'm telling you is I didn't have a whole lot to do with that one. But no, so when he sent us the demo, Lee called me and said, hey, what do you think about that post-chorus thing? Like, do you like that? And I was like, dude, that's what makes it a hit. And he's like, really? Like, Lee wasn't sure about it, but.
Because it is a bit progressive.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like I was going to say, there's the effect that McGraw puts on it too here,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I think McGraw, what he's often done consistently, but often done really right, is do some cool, odd, progressive things inside mm-hmm. of very traditional country type music.
Yeah. And that was, Jaron did a kind of a version of that, and then Tim took it like a whole nother step into the kind of weird world with that little part.
Who's the artist that, as you write, you feel like you write the best for who? Like their sensibilities and what they're going to pick, and not who you have the most cuts with, mm-hmm. but you go, man, like their life and what they sing about, or they as an artist, like I get that. Mm-hmm. Who would you say that artist is for you?
I would probably say Jason Aldean.
Which you do have number ones with Jason.
Yeah.
And why do you think you and Jason kind of relate on a level?
I mean, he wants to cut those kind of, you know, rock-tinged, redneck, driving down a back road, kind of out in the country, kind of tougher songs.
I feel tractor songs too. Like when you talk about somebody riding a tractor.
Yeah.
Like you know, a lot of my family growing up also worked on farms. Mm-hmm. And I think about them like driving the freaking truck, the big truck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a dump truck or if it's a tractor. Like those Aldean songs remind me of that. You got four, and your very first ever number one was with Jason, right?
Right.
Why? Here's Jason Aldean, why. Here you go.
Sometimes I wonder why does it always have to come down to you leaving before I say I love you.
What's the story with this one? And not so much the writing of it, but because it was your first number one, how many cuts on the record until they put it out as a single?
That was his I think his second single he ever put out.
Did you feel like when you wrote it and he cut it, not knowing yet if it was going to be a single, that it would be a single?
I didn't have any idea. And I didn't have any idea Jason would be big. I mean, Michael Knox kept, you know, I'd run into him and he's like, hey, man, we're going to cut three of your songs on Jason. And I knew Jason, but you just never know. And I wrote that song with John Rich, by the way, and Vicky McGeehee. But John had Hicktown, which was the first single. This was the second single. And this was a song that I was kind of a little bit of a head-scratcher to me, that I didn't really ever think it'd be a single, because it's about a guy being mean to a girl. And the song is like almost like, well, I want to be nice to you, you know? But for some reason, women really like the song. I don't know.
I'll run through your Aldean catalog here of number ones. Burning It Down from Aldean. When you guys wrote this, because I remember we played this song on my show for the first time. And again, we talk about progressive type music, and there's a lot of a lot of different kind of bass, a lot of effects that maybe Jason had to use. When you guys wrote it, did you picture it as that kind of song, or did you write it straight ahead?
We wrote it more straight ahead. It had that underneath it, which I think those are the actual, the low end, like the bass and the part of that groove was tracks that they took from when we wrote that. But we had it more like rock and roll version of it, with harmonies on it and stuff. And for whatever reason, they decided to take it the other way. I thought they would take it even more the direction that we did it, but they took it the other way, which surprised me. And I was actually a little bit scared. I didn't know how people would react to that, to the way that they did it. But it was kind of ahead of the curve there a little bit. So
yeah, I think actually opened up a lot of doors for those kind of rock and country guys to experiment a bit with. Again, some of that deep bass, some of that super percussion type stuff. A couple more Aldean tracks, number one for you. Take a Little Ride.
I'm just waiting to ride this Chevy down a little back road.
And we'll go back to Crazy Town. Here you go.
It's a crazy town.
This is early-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And still, this is, as far as Jason goes, really one of those songs that when I think of Jason Aldean, like this is one of those songs that to me kind of identifies him in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So who'd you write Crazy Town with? Do you remember?
A guy named Brett Jones. He's been in town for a while. He's had, I think he had a Big McGraw cut. I mean, a Big McGraw number one back in the day. But yeah, he called me up and we got together and he had that idea and we wrote it and demoed it. And I mean, it's like those two songs, like Take a Little Ride and Crazy Town, that's kind of like my wheelhouse, or it was for a long time anyway. And Jason, that seems like it's kind of his wheelhouse too. So
Does he ever hit you up and go, hey, I need a song? We've done it right so many times. What you got?
I mean, I do have an open invitation to send him anything at any time. I have his number, but I don't have anything on the new record. So I've been recently, I don't know, I've just kind of maybe at some point I felt like I've written all those songs already. Man, I've been having a blast trying to write stuff for Morgan Wallen, and have a couple on the new Dustin Lynch record that's fixing to come out. And there's a new guy over at Big Loud that's coming out named Ernest. And, man, he's a really great songwriter and fun guy to write with. So there's some young guys that I've really been clicking with and, you know, just trying to do something different.
You know, what's interesting to me, and again, we'll get back to your catalog. We're not going to be able to touch it all. This is not the documentary like, oh boy, did 18 hours. It could be. This could be that. We could do like an 18-hour podcast documentary on your tracks. So don't be offended if we don't touch them all here. Okay, so this is nuts because I went a little deeper on you. And so you wrote a Nickelback song.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is crazy. So, and you have another one in another country with a Nickelback song, which Lullaby from Nickelback. Mike, play me because I didn't know this song. I hope you're not offended, Rodney. All right, here we go. It went number one in Poland. Now, do you go to the number one party in Poland? Is there one?
That's the first time. No, I had no idea it went number one.
We're breaking news here. Wow. Yeah, you can add another number one to your list.
I will. I guess I'm up.
It went number one in Poland. In the U.S., it went number 15 on the rock chart. But in Poland, you have a number one. Have you ever seen the documentary Searching for Silverman?
Oh, yeah.
That's what you are in Poland. Okay. You don't even know that. If you go back, you're this huge rock god. How wild would that be, Mike? If he goes back, he doesn't even know it. That's how many number ones he has. He didn't even know he's huge in another country.
Yeah. That was a fun one to write, though, because we got the opportunity to write with Chad Kroeger because he was coming to town wanting to write country stuff. And we just stumbled on that idea, and he's like, wait, this could be a Nickelback song. So then we went totally into like Nickelback world, like every line had to have the exact same syllables and the exact same inner rhyme in the same spot, you know, that world. But it was kind of the beginning of the end of Nickelback too. So it was
except in Poland, which by the way, they were just blowing up. So Nickelback is just ending. But tell me about that Chad Kroeger. Like, he wanted to come and write country or a country artist?
No. He had actually had another song that had been a single. I can't remember. That did pretty well on somebody.
The soundtrack? Was it the...
He got a cut.
Oh, he wrote a song for somebody else.
I think he wrote a song with Brett James that somebody cut, and I think it went top 10. So he was like, would come to town, and when Nickelback was in between records and want to write, and we got to know Joey Moy,
the producer,
through Chad.
Yeah.
And I ended up calling Joey because I knew Joey was wanting to maybe start doing some country stuff. I talked Joey into cutting a song on with that Jake Owen had of mine. And Joey and I went in and cut that song on Jake, and we ended up getting to finish the whole record together, and that was Joey's first country production in the U.S. And then the next thing he did was FGL.
Florida Georgia Line, yeah.
So that's so that the whole Chad thing turned into the FGL Joey Moy thing.
That's kind of wild how that all shakes out.
Yeah.
What song did you write where someone goes, I don't think that's it? And then it ended up kind of digging its way through and ended up being a big hit. Maybe don't call anybody out here. I don't know. We're not searching for that. But someone goes, they're like, Ronnie, I don't think this has got legs to it. But you believed in it and ended up doing something. Or none of them. They're just all so good. Immediately when they hear them, like, my ears are just.
I don't know. I can't. I mean, usually it's more the other way. I'm going like, this is a hit, this is a hit. Yeah. And it's not. You know, so.
Which of your songs were you most surprised that it was a smash?
Because
I can rattle some of these off, man.
I would say Justin Moore, Letting the Night Roll. That surprised me.
Because?
I don't know. I just didn't. He hadn't up to that point cut anything. Kind of that was a little more progressive for him. And we wrote it together, but I just didn't think it would. You know, I thought it would be kind of at the back of the pack. You know, for singles for him. So that one surprised me.
So, you know, sometimes I'll have buddies who will go, you know what, I wrote this song 4 years ago. I hadn't heard about it in forever. And then all of a sudden I get a call like, hey, we're going to cut this song. You ever have any of those that kind of get stashed away for a bit or just kind of float around? And someone goes, you know, I was going through some songs and found this one.
I've had, I actually just had that happen with two different artists. And knock on wood, I don't know if either one of them will end up making the record, but Kenny Chesney has a song for his new record that he cut in 2015 and it didn't make the record. And about a year ago, he called up me and David Lee Murphy and he said, hey man, I still love this song, but the first verse isn't right. Can y'all rewrite the first verse? So we went in and rewrote the first verse. And then I think Kenny and David Lee Murphy out on the road rewrote it again. And Kenny just played it for me out in LA and he's excited about it. So I think it has a decent shot at making the record. But that song
pretty wild.
Was originally cut 4 years ago and then had the same thing happen with Keith Urban. So,
and both tracks aren't out yet.
Keith, I wrote a song with Ashley Gourley and Keith cut it 4 or 5 years ago. And then about a year ago, he told me he had recut it. And then about 6 months ago, he told me, he said, man, the mix turned out really good, but who knows if it'll end up making the record. But it's funny that song just like popped back up 4 years later.
You bring up Kenny Chesney. Have you been riding with Kenny?
Just a little bit. I've only ridden with him a couple of other times and then just got to go out to California and write with him. Basically just trying to write up tempos for his new record. So
what is that like? Does he go, everybody, we're going to fly you out, or does he book you a ticket, or does he get put you on a plane?
No, we bought our own tickets. Us a house, but it was on Malibu Beach, so it was badass.
So he got you guys a house,
right?
And how many of you move into the house?
There were 6 riders.
Okay, and so you go in, and then is he a part of that?
Yeah.
Or do you guys just kind of run and do your thing, and he checks in?
We would split up, and half of us would go ride with Kenny, and half of us would stay at the house and try to ride a Kenny Chesney up tempo, and we did that for 3 days.
And how does that turn out?
It turned out great.
Yeah.
So when you know, like, here's where, you know, Kenny's up tempo, you know, there's kind of a, you know, where the lines are on that and what to keep it between for the most part. And all three of my Kenny singles have been up tempo. So I guess that's why I got the call. You know, kind of what he wants. So you sit down and there's no reason to do anything else. So it's kind of good because everybody's looking for an up tempo all the time. So it forces you to have to write one.
Here is American Kids. It's one of your big ones with Kenny. Boy, this was a monster. Like when I think of my time in Nashville, which has been about 6+ years, this is one of the monsters that kind of just crept up. I remember seeing the album art. It was like a bus on the sand or something, or with blue sky behind it. I'm just going from memory here. And I was like, okay, well, let's see what Kenny's got. And this one just smashed.
Yeah, it was a fun one. This is one of those kind of unicorn songs that you don't see it coming, and you've never written a song like that, and no matter how hard you try afterwards, you can't, you know, you can't write another one.
What does it feel like when you finish, though? When you finish a song that ends up being amazing, do you feel amazing when you're done with the write, or is it just like, oh, you did?
That was with Shane McAnally and Luke Laird, and when we finished that song, we were like, holy crap, who do we need to be very strategic about who we send it to first.
Because somebody that gets it that you may not think would have as much success with it because of who they are could actually hurt the song.
Right.
That's interesting because you don't want to have a free-for-all because some artist that maybe doesn't have a prominent place at a label where they're really going to put the money behind promoting them could get the song.
Well, yeah, that and, you know, another artist that it just might not be the right song for will think, that's a big old hit song, and they'll try to do it, but it might not, you know, it might not be their, in their strength category doing a song like that. But it was kind of one of those, you know, a little bit down a different path for Kenny. He had never cut anything with that kind of a feel before, and yet it sounded like he'd always done a song like that.
Yeah, it still sounded, when I remember hearing that song, you're going, well, this is a bit different, but it's very Kenny at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't feel like he was trying to tackle some new musical ground.
Yeah.
And again, I think a lot of that, too, was the packaging of the song. Like, just all the way around the video, the art, you know, how Kenny was talking about the song.
Yeah, and we got to all go in and sing on it, too. We did all, I mean, us and our wives and other people went in and you know, one day and did a bunch of the background vocals on it. So it was cool to get to have a part of it like that too. And I would say probably, I know his Get Along song that he just sat out last year, which is, I love that song. I think it's a great song. It's, to me, it was kind of like a American Kid Cousin, which Shane wrote it. But
that's the same kind of.
Yeah. It's probably the you know, 4 or 5 years later, it's a distant cousin to American Kids. But when I heard it, I was like, oh yeah, Shane was able to kind of catch that groove again. So.
Tell me if this is true. You wrote Sunshine and Summertime specifically for Kenny, but it ended up being a top five for Faith.
Right.
So how do you write a song specifically for someone? Like, how did that come into you to write that song?
We had that idea, just in the idea and the feel of it. And once again, that was with John Rich. And it just sounded like when we got through, I mean, when we knew Kenny was cutting, we had people who could just, you know, hand the song to him or Buddy. And we had that idea and we tried to write it for Kenny.
And so when he says it's not for me, or maybe it doesn't get back to you that it's not for him, not sure.
No, I mean, we got somebody, you know, he passed on it.
Okay, so then do you go, well, let's just see who likes it, or do you then target Faith?
Well,
because it seems quite the transition to go from Kenny to
Big
Faith.
Big and Rich was on the road. They were opening for a Tim and Faith tour, and I think John handed it to Faith. So kind of had the inside track on that one.
Yeah, like that. That's a good one.
So, which on that record, John had Mississippi Girl, which is the first single, and then he had this single also.
I just, you know, I have so many of your songs up here. Do you have to sometimes study what songs went number one until you can remember? Because I you know, you're being humble. I'll relate just a bit. I've written a couple books, and sometimes I forget the stories I wrote in my books, and people will bring them up and be like, hey, and I know the stories because they're from my life, but I have to, like, see what I wrote again. I wonder...
To remember the way you told it.
Yeah. This is like times 10 with all these songs. Do you ever just look at it before you hop in and be like, oh, yeah, that's right. I wrote Blake Shelton. Sure be cool if you did. Like, do you have to freshen up?
I mean, I have a pretty good memory of which ones went number one and which ones didn't.
Do you have a room in your house with all your plaques? Or in your seven houses?
Yeah, I mean, I do, but they're rapidly becoming more of my wife's plaques than mine, so...
Which is also an interesting wrinkle into this. So Nicole Galyon, your wife, Nicole Clausen, whichever, how, right. You know.
Galyon, since we're talking
we're
about music.
Yeah, so. Yeah, of course. You guys don't write together that often.
We write maybe once or twice a year.
That's not that often.
No.
When you go home, I'm sure you have to talk about music a bit, like, hey, how'd the day go? Mm-hmm. You know, what songwriters you guys like writing with, what songwriters you don't. What's that competitive feeling there?
We talk about music all the time, but we've kind of strategically over the years, just because it's so, when we first got married, I'd had quite a bit of success and she hadn't ever even had a cut. She got a publishing deal right after we got married. So we strategically, she kept her name, and we strategically tried to write with other people because if we wrote a song together, and I've seen it happen with other couples, if we wrote a song together, people would just presume that it was me, even though she's awesome, and she's doing way better than me right now in the last couple of years. So just as far as career building and branding and all that goes, I tried to help her build her career to where if she had success, she would get the credit for it. And we've been lucky enough, it's worked out that way.
So what is her favorite song that you have written? And then I'm going to switch it up after this and ask you the same thing about her. But what is her favorite song that you have written? Where she's like, man, that's the one I love. Oh, that's why I fell in love with you, because you wrote Crash My Party from Luke Bryan. I was at a bar and it played.
I would guess either I Saw God Today or American Kids.
Okay.
If you ask her that.
So George Strait, I Saw God Today, number one. Boy, what a big one. What, I mean, how about getting George Strait to sing words that you thought in your mind?
Well, and I grew up in Texas, and that's the only George Strait cut I ever got, because I wrote stuff that I felt like my wheelhouse was like Jason Aldean, and so, you know, I never thought I would get a George Strait cut. So that was pretty amazing.
That song, by the way, CMA Single of the Year, and was nominated for Best Country Song at the 2009 Grammy Awards. And although all that happened, I would argue, and again, I don't really come from a good place to argue this, but just having George Strait cut a song would be as equal to actually getting a CMA Single of the Year nomination. Or an award. Would you rather, let me bring this down, would you rather have random artist, he sings a song that you have written, and it wins for CMA Single of the Year, or get a George Strait number one without that award? You win the award.
I would say George Strait. George Strait number one.
I'm glad you said that. I like you better because you did. Just letting you know. Here, I need you to convince me on something, because I haven't started it yet, but Succession is what my co-host is watching, what I hear a lot of friends talk about. Mm-hmm. You're watching the show?
I love the show.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite shows.
Tell me why I would like Succession. Like, what is the deal? Like, what's the hook of this show that's going to make me go, all right, that's my show?
I think it really has great acting. It's got great, the script storyline has been really great.
What's it even about?
It's about, billionaire multimedia family.
So like yours. So that's what it is. You see a lot of your family in this.
Let's get it.
Thousandaire. Anyway, the dad, there's four kids. They're all, you can tell they've all been brought up kind of spoiled trust fund kids, and they think dad's about to pull the ripcord, and they're all angling to try to position to see if they can get the company. But they're all, every character is like flawed. There's not one redeeming character in the whole thing.
And you like the show?
I love the show.
You like it enough to recommend it to me? Like, publicly.
I highly recommend it.
And what network is that?
I quit watching Billions when Succession came on, because I was just like, which the first couple of seasons of Billions was really good. But like by season three, it was just kind of like you could tell like they'd only thought the storyline out through a couple of seasons.
Yeah.
And like when I watched the first couple of episodes of Succession, it was just like Billions was such a letdown at that point. I was like, quit watching. So
I'm going to ask, I forgot to ask the other side of this question. What's your favorite song that Nicole's written? It ended up being a big one.
I would say Automatic.
Early. Mm-hmm. Yeah, early for her. Why that song?
I remember the night she brought that song home, and she played me when she played me the demo of it, and I kind of got teary-eyed, and I was like, you did it. You did it. That's a smash. That's a number one song. And we didn't even know, you know, if it would make Miranda's record at that point, but it was, I mean, that's a no-brainer when you hear it. It just sounds like a big old hit song.
Your son, and I know this because, not to brag on both of us, but we're both in the Country Music Hall of Fame right now as an exhibit. I have my exhibit, and you have an exhibit. It's you, your son Brad, and Nicole, and you're all in this together. We were all at the big award, you know, the big opening ceremony.
Yeah.
So your son has a number one as well, Up Down, Morgan Wallen.
Yeah.
What kind of advice do you give him? First of all, not day to day, but were you ever like, I don't know about the song, right? Because I would never want somebody that I know to get involved in what I do.
I did everything I could to steer him in other directions, but with the success that I was having, it was hard for me to say, no, you can't, this is impossible, you can't do this. Because, you know, I was doing it. So when he told me he wanted to be a songwriter, he was working at the North Face store at the mall and valeting cars at the Omni Hotel downtown.
How old was he?
He was probably, he'd just gotten out of college. He's probably 24. And he said, I think I want to be a songwriter, Dad. And so I had a Pro Tools rig in my office that I had kind of started using and quickly figured out, like, I should probably just stick to writing songs and not waste 5 years of my life trying to figure this out. I said, hey, there's a Pro Tools rig up in my office. Come by and get it. And I basically told him, like, if you want to write songs, start writing songs. And we kind of played his deal the same way that we did with Nicole. I didn't, you know, I told him, I said, you could write 20 songs. I could walk you into a publisher and get you a deal just because of my track record. But that doesn't help you any at all. Like, we could write every day and you could get some cuts, but that doesn't help your career, like, as far as the longevity and your brand, that doesn't help you. So he kind of, you know, he went out there and he found his buddies who write songs and he built his friend group, and he's in this whole young wave of guys. You know, he wrote that song with Michael Hardy. He's got another buddy named Grayling James that they've just been killing it. They've got two or three cuts on the new Chris Jansen record that's fixing to come out. I think they have the title cut.
The one with him and Blake, Chris and Blake, the Real Friends?
Yeah, Real Friends, yeah.
Wow, is that genetic? So, or did he see you do it? Like, how does that even happen?
I don't know. I mean, our personalities are a lot alike. We're kind of laid back and kind of, you know, we can hang out in the room with people. So,
walk me through, what's the key to writing a great opening line? Like, is there something where you're going, all right, we got to start this song strong? Like, what's the key to writing a great opening? Because this is the Country Songwriters Podcast. They're all listening. I get so many messages from people, one, trying to get on this, and then two, going, I love when you have people on that actually talk about the weeds of songwriting. So an opening line of a song, how important is it?
It's very important, and it's hard to do. You always try to kind of, you know, it just depends on the song. Sometimes you go for a little bit of shock value. Sometimes you go for the trying to set up the hook here early in the song. People won't until you get down to the chorus, they won't realize what that first line of the song was about.
But, like, Fast. Let's go back to Fast, all right? Luke Bryan, Fast. You know, that song kind of goes all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a lot of
different. It starts out with the title of the song.
Go ahead.
The first line of the song is Fast. That's the kind of car you want. That's the kind of car you want when you're 18. Fast. That's the kind of boys that you want on the home team. That's the only song I've ever written that has the title all through the verse.
Let's hear this. Let me make sure you're telling the truth. Ah, there you go. You got me. He's telling the truth, Mike. That's the kind of car you want. All right, let me switch it up then. I'm just going to pick one at random up here on the list of 10 million songs. How about Blake Shelton, Drink on It? Do you remember the first line of that song?
I just thought of the first line of Cool. Sure Be Cool If You Did.
All right, this is Sure Be Cool If You Did.
I don't remember the first line of Drink on It.
What's the first line of Sure Be Cool If You Did?
I was going to keep it real, like, chill, like, only have a drink or two.
Okay, so talk about that in a room. How does that, what does that start? Do you guys start with the title, the idea, and then kind of work back?
Mm-hmm.
Explain that to me.
Well, we had the idea, which came from Dazed and Confused, the movie Matthew McConaughey,
you're telling the truth. I don't doubt you anymore. Yeah, I don't. You got me.
There was a part in the movie where Matthew McConaughey's, like, driving a car. He looks in the back seat, asks this kid if he's got any weed, and the kid said, "Oh man, no, I don't have any." And Matthew McConaughey's, "Man, it'd be a whole lot cooler if you did." And that's where we got the idea for the song. And I had actually written that idea down a couple of different times over the years, and it just seemed to be that day. I threw that idea out to the room, and Chris Tompkins was like, "Man, what if we write it like?" And he kind of figured out the angle on it, and then we had the angle for the chorus, and then we went back, and so the first verse is about a guy, basically, like, "Man, I was just planning on coming out and having one drink tonight," but just kind of sets up the hook.
Who did you see early on that started out as a writer or was writing before they get their artist deal that ended up being big deal, big star?
An artist or song?
Yeah, an artist.
an artist?
Because most will start with a publishing deal and come to town and write songs and learn how to write for themselves. And you get in a room and they're early, but then they ended up being a big star later that when you met them, they really weren't.
I would say, I mean, Luke Bryan, I wrote with him right about the time his first single hadn't come out, but he had had, as a writer, he had had good directions on Billy Currington. And we wrote a couple of things. I think one of those songs made his second record, maybe. But he was, you know, he was just writing, and he had a record deal, and he, you know, had a single fixing to come out. But you had no idea whether he was going to be big or not. So, but we've written off and on over the last 15 years. So.
When you're writing with him, are you like, that guy's pretty sharp? Do you feel like that?
He is. I mean, most of these guys are, you know, they're like, I don't know if you would say they're as a whole, they're genius personalities, but they have parts of their personality that they're like borderline genius in, and that's why they're so good at what they do. I mean, the crazy thing for me is like writing with Luke that first time, I would have never thought I would ever see him on TV on American Idol. It would be like, he just keeps surprising everybody with what he can do.
He walks into a room and it's like, oh, that guy's a star.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell even in the room, because I work on Idol with him, and even in the room where there's a lot of stars, Luke is the dominant force in the room. Because he just comes in, and I'll say this about Luke too, Luke and I are basically the only two that are on time every time. You know, everybody gets there at their own pace. First of all, Hollywood's way different than Nashville. Like, when it's 1:30 and the call time is 1:30, first of all, I'm going to be there because I'm by far the least star of that whole thing. But Luke is there too. And he's like, all right, let's go to work. It's like, as much as, you know, Luke is now a big star and playing, you know, stadiums, the dude shows up at 1:30.
Oh, yeah. And he showed up back then too when he didn't have much going on. He showed up on time, you know.
Were you ever wanted to be an artist? Is that ever a thing for you? That's a dream?
No, I was a little bit, like I said, when I first started coming to Nashville, I was in my 30s already, and I never, you know, the people that I've known that wanted to do it, it's almost like you got to be willing to sell your soul to the devil to do it, you know, and I was never that. I was like, oh, you know, every once in a while I'd be kind of, oh, maybe I should try to be an artist. But, like, that's definitely not – you have to have way more fire behind it than that. So I love songwriting. I love staying in town. I love to hunt and fish. I tell people I'd rather spend 150 days a year on my boat, not on a bus, so, which I rarely get to spend time on my boat anymore. But
I bet you got, like, 10 boats. One in every town.
I have one boat.
I have this imaginary land of you just dominating all. How about, you ever written a song and realized that you and I'll preface it by saying this before it seems any sort of accusation. I sometimes will write jokes and go, oh, can't do that joke because I think I was inspired by another joke. I didn't even realize it when I wrote this joke. And I go, I can't go out on stage and do it because I didn't do it on purpose. But I think if I'm looking back, I probably heard Chris Rock or someone do a joke that inspired this joke, and I go, got to pull it. Not sure, but got to pull it. That ever happened with a song?
Yeah.
Where you go, oh, didn't do it on purpose, but I think I might have been influenced.
Yeah.
And what do you do in that case?
You have to be diligent. You know, if you think like, oh, crap, I'm on something I've already written, or somebody else might have said something, that they might think I got this idea from them.
That's a thing, too. That's not even stealing a song. That's just somebody else talking, huh? Mm-hmm.
Get on the phone, talk to them, figure it out. I had one song one time that we finished. We went in, we demoed the song. I brought it home. I'd already sent it to, I think I sent it to Dierks Bentley, and he liked it. He's like, oh, dude, I love that. I want to hold it. And I got home, and I played it for Nicole. I said, hey, listen to this song. I sent it to Dierks, and he loves it. And she said, that's a Darius Rucker song. And I went back, and it was, I can't remember what single it was, but it was literally, the chorus was like note for note, a Darius Rucker song. And I had to call Dierks and say, hey, we're all over the top of a Darius song. I didn't realize it. Let me try to tweak the melody out to change it so it's not on top of a Darius song. And then that was the end of it, you know, because then it's not the same anymore. It just kind of ruins it. So
why do you think that happens? Do you think that it's our subconscious storing something? We just kind of fall on it, or did you accidentally fall on it, do you think?
Oh, I'd probably heard the song and it just came back out. I definitely didn't say like, hey, let's write a song like this Darius song. I just didn't. Maybe I heard it on the radio on the way into town, and it was in there, and it came back out. I don't know, but you got to be diligent about it. And when you think, you got to communicate with people about it too. If you think you're on top of somebody, or you got to get on the phone and talk to them, and they might still be pissed, but they're not going to be near as pissed as they would be if they found out and you didn't tell them. So,
well, then I should let you know that I wrote a song yesterday called that. I met a bartender. Sounds a little similar to yours. I'm glad we're having this talk right now because that was the number one of yours, bartender. It's not exactly the same, but it's
met a bartender.
Yeah, I met a bartender.
One word difference.
It's again, some people would confuse it if they heard it, but just from me to you, it just happened to fall out. But listen, you have all these. Luke Bryan drunk on you. Luke Bryan fast. Luke Bryan crash my party. Florida Georgia Line dirt. Florida Georgia Line, get your shine on. Florida Georgia Line around here. Lady A Bartender, Big and Rich Lost in This Moment. By the way, their first number one. How about that coming back? You write John Rich's first number one in Big and Rich after you were his basketball coach.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And they had that song for a while. We wrote that song with Keith Anderson, who also had a record deal and was having hits at that same time. And neither one of them cut it for their first record. And then when it rolled around time for record two, they both cut it, and then they were kind of in a race to see who could get it out first. So it's funny, that's a song that sat around for 3 years and nobody wanted it, and then all of a sudden two different people were kind of fighting over it. So
we're going to end with this. I'm going to give you three random questions we have here. All you got to do is answer these to the best that you can, and we'll move on with life. What is the last movie you saw in theaters?
Tarantino movie.
The Once Upon a Time?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Mike, you saw that, huh?
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Did you like it?
Really good.
I'm going to go watch The Joker tonight.
Wow.
Have you seen Joker yet?
No.
I guess that would be the answer if you had. What a stupid question. By
it looks good, though.
Yeah, I know. Okay, what's one thing under 100 bucks everyone should own? One thing under 100 bucks that everyone should own.
Oh, man, that's a tough one.
You know what my new one is? The Squatty Potty. That's under 100. Yeah, yeah, I have one downstairs. And this is not an endorsement. I was just thinking about, you know, in my head, like, what would I recommend right now? Not the most glamorous thing to recommend, by the way. You don't want to talk about taking a dump, right? That's not something that really is like, but yeah, I would now throw the Squatty Potty out there as, if I'm jumping in this, the thing under 100 bucks that I think everybody should own.
Under 100 bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you got?
I got some I have some workout shorts. I think they're called 10,000. I think they're like $70.
Okay.
Best workout shorts I've ever had. They have a liner in them already and all that. So.
Those are swimming trunks, Rodney. I'm sorry to tell you. They feel like panties. Listen to this. One time, Rodney, you talk about the shorts with a liner. I have a pool back here. And I was in the pool and I was swimming around and I was like, what is that feeling? And so I reach, I'm so stupid. I'm embarrassed telling the story. I reach in and I forget I have swimming trunks on. And that liner, you know, it feels like, you know, soft. Mm. And I felt it and I was like, oh my God, did I put on some girl's panties and I didn't realize it? And for a minute I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm wearing something. But it was the liner. It's a really trivial story, but that was a real life thing that happened to me. I thought I had some girl's panties on. Yeah. They got mixed up.
The liners can feel weird sometimes.
Yeah.
But sometimes they can feel like the compression shorts that you put on when you work out too.
There was no compression here. This was just panty. This is straight panty. One final thing. Let's go. The last concert you had to buy tickets for.
Last concert I had to buy tickets for would have been when the Eagles came to town.
With Vince?
Yeah, was that the year before last? A year and a half ago.
I went as well, Bridgestone.
Yeah.
And you bought tickets?
Yes.
Because?
Because I don't know anybody.
You don't know anybody.
I don't know anybody in the Eagles.
All right. Well, listen, we've done it. We've talked about it. Rodney Llama on Instagram.
Right.
How active are you over there?
I try to post at least once a week,
so
which is pretty good for someone my age, I'd say.
I,
which is about like 1/10 of what my wife posts.
I don't know if 1/10 is fair.
Like 1/100.
She's the greatest on Instagram. Rodney, why Llama?
That's back to John Rich. He used to call me the Rodney Llama.
Because?
And I was like,
did you spit on him?
I'm kind of calm. No. Dalai Llama, Rodney Llama.
Oh, kinda, now I get it.
I don't even know if that's the right religion or not, but.
I think they all do ohms.
Yeah,
little bit.
So Rodney Llama's just memorable.
Yeah. All right. Well, there it's we stuck. Have it. That you have more songs than we could fit on the wall. So that should be your biggest honor. We're going to send you the championship belt.
Okay.
That we talk. Check the mail. Like, so when we're recording this, it's on the 11th, but start checking your mail about like the 20th. Every day, okay. Go out to the mailbox, check your mail, and see if that championship belt's okay. There. Okay. Because we send it to the top three.
I'll post it on my Instagram.
When you get it, post it, and then we'll both be good. All right. That's it. Episode 2. We really appreciate it. Listen, we recorded this on a Friday, and, you know, I know that. You're a busy person, and I was literally in town for like a day and a half, so I'm so glad that you agreed to come over and do this.
I'm busy, but I'm not near as busy as you.
Not so accurate.
Thank you for
however, I'm very appreciative of you coming over on a Friday and doing this with me. Something we've been looking forward to for a while, and I know you and I have met in passing many times, but now we have many things to talk about right. Next time we see each other. When I watch Succession and go, dude, you were right, or why did you make me buy all those episodes? What network is that on?
HBO.
Oh, so I already
HBO.
Have it. Yeah. I already have it. Okay, all right. Yeah. All right, there he is, Rodney Clausen, @RodneyLlama on Instagram. We'll see you guys next time.